I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Bill Clinton nominated Ruth Bader Ginsburg to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. She was sworn in 27 years ago in 1993. Known today as a tireless advocate for gender equality and support of women's rights, you might be surprised to learn that a number of women's groups opposed her candidacy to the highest court because of her criticism of Roe v. Wade. She has since become a pop icon, especially among liberal court watchers. She's described her judicial philosophy as incremental, even at times conservative. That's what she told our guest, Jeffrey Rosen, the CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, author of Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and the Law. The Constitution Center is giving Ginsburg, this year's Liberty Medal in an online ceremony tomorrow, Thursday evening. 2020 also marks the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote. Today on Radio Times, talking to RGB. Welcome back to Radio Times, Jeffrey Rosen.
Great to be back.
Nice to have you back, and I should say to our listeners, joining us by Skype. Let me begin when you first met Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You were a clerk. You were working in Washington, D.C. She was a judge at the time. You happened to get on the elevator at the same time. And in order to break this, what felt like kind of stony silence to you, you asked her about opera. What did she say?
She opened up. It's her favorite topic. And it was just a serendipitous question. As you say, we were on the elevator and she has a kind of formidable presence. And she was silent in the way that those who don't know her, as I didn't at the time, might mistake for remoteness. But I couldn't think of anything else to say. I just asked her, what operas have you seen recently? Because I love opera, and I didn't even know that she was an opera fan, but of course she is, and it was the first thing that came into my mind. I'm no good at talking about sports, so I asked about opera, and it was the right question to ask.
Talk and about she, a serendipitous question, right?
Well, it was a serendipitous question, and it was a serendipitous encounter. I was clerking for another judge. She was a very distinguished judge on the court, and we just ran into each other and hit it off. And that began a lifelong discussion about music, about opera, and about law that's continued to this day and has been one of the greatest blessings of my life.
You've known her then for almost 30 years now. Do you call her Ruth? What do you call her?
No, of course not. She signed her letters to me years ago, RBG, so I would address her as RBG in letters, but I would call her Justice, as I always do. She's far too exalted to call by her first name.
What do you make, and frankly, what does she make of this whole RBG pop icon celebrity status that she has now? Was that a surprise to her?
Yes, it really was. And it's as you said in your introduction, Marty, when she was appointed to the Supreme Court, she was viewed as a judge's judge and incrementalist. Even all of her towering achievements as an advocate in the 1970s were not as celebrated then in the 1990s as they properly are today. So when she joined the Supreme Court, she was initially surprised by the interest in her, and she talked about the fact that when it was reported that she would read briefs in movie theaters, because she's constantly working, kind citizens from around the country sent her flashlights, and that was the beginning of her public presence. But it really wasn't until 2013 when she issued her Shelby County dissent. That was the case involving voting rights, where she fiercely dissented from the court's decision to strike down part of the voting rights amendments. And then a young NYU student created a meme, the notorious RBG, which went viral, that she became a pop culture icon. And she was extreme. Of course, she was surprised. She was bemused that strangers would come up to her on the street and ask to take selfies with her. But she just leaned right into it and enjoys it and has a notorious RBG tote bag that she carries around herself. And in her chambers, she's got some of the best of the pop art that concerned citizens are constantly sending to her. So she takes it with a grain of salt, but she is both surprised and appreciative of the great affection that people have for her.
Tell us, I mean, this is such a sort of basic question, but tell us what she is like. And I say that only because, as you describe, this kind of stony silence that to outsiders looks a bit formidable. She doesn't give much away when it comes to things like body language or responding. But clearly, she's a woman of intense, strong and deeply held opinions and ideas, not just about the law, but I'm sure about life itself. What is it like to be with her in kind of a casual setting?
Well, it's just extraordinary. And she's one of the most extraordinary human beings of our time. And her presence and focus is so unusual. She does not have time for small talk or chit-chat. She conserves her energies, and she's perfectly happy to be silent if she's not engaged in a conversation, so that she can be thinking of other things. In the tribute video that we're going to broadcast tomorrow, I guess I can share a story that her granddaughter tells, where they're sitting at the dinner table, and Justice Ginsburg is sort of silent, and then all of a sudden she'll just blurt out an observation about abortion rights that's extraordinary in its prescience and precision. Her mind is always working, and when you are in public interviews, it's really important to sit in the silence, because there are long pauses between questions and answers, longer than is comfortable in normal conversation. But those, her friends and those who know her, realize that it's in the pauses that she's thinking deeply, and then she'll just, if you wait for it, will come out with something completely extraordinary. And her attention to detail, both, of course, legal details, to every comma, to every adjective, to every word that goes out under her name, as well as to the details of people's lives, the precise travails and struggles that they have, and who married whom, and what happened to the plaintiffs in her cases afterward, is also just mind-boggling. So it's just, I've never encountered any other person who is can seem formidable and reserved in public. Her husband used to say, people wrongly think that my wife is a cold fish, he would say, because she had a reputation for being austere. But in fact, she's one of the warmest and most empathetic and concerned and deeply feeling and compassionate people imaginable. It's just that she conserves her energy so that every single moment of her attention is focused on the task at hand. She is completely tuned in to whatever she's doing in a way that has no time for distractions. It's just remarkable.
Well, she did marry you. You and your wife, she married you. And she also edited the final sentence of your vows. Jeffrey, how did she add, subtract that final sentence?
I mean, it's just so typical of her. She married us. It was a great honor, and we were going to do it at the Supreme Court. And she said, she sent some drafts of vows that other couples had used in the past, and she said, send me your edits by 4 p.m. on Tuesday. So Tuesday, or whatever it was, arrived, and we were thinking of other stuff, something having to do with the wedding. And an email arrives at 10 in the morning from her assistant: Justice Ginsburg is expecting your edits by 4 p.m. We thought, oh my goodness. So we got down and sent our edits, just changing a little bit, sent it in at 3:30 or something like that. At, 4:02, the email comes back from Justice Ginsburg with her edits. And she had taken a sentence that she had used for many couples in the past and that we had adopted, and she altered it. The sentence originally read, the obvious one, Jeffrey, you may kiss the bride. And she edited it to, Jeffrey and Lauren, you may embrace for the first kiss of your marriage. And that edit, that alteration, to make it an embrace of equality, both of us sharing our first embrace, was typical of her constantly revising her own language to make it more embraceive. And this is this remarkable word that Justice Ginsburg used with me in several of our interviews, and she uses with others. She sees the Constitution and American society as growing constantly more embraceive. And when I asked her what she meant by that word, she said, embracing the left out people, not just grudgingly, but with open arms. It's the most beautiful vision of a Constitution that comes to embrace previously excluded people like African-Americans and then women and immigrants and LGBTQ people, and always extending the promise of equality of the Declaration of Independence to make it more and more embracive. And it's the core of her personal and judicial philosophy.
Well, and I do want to get to all that and talk about some of the decisions and her dissents and her writing of some of these decisions. But I am curious, and I think everyone is concerned about her health. She had another bout of cancer, or certainly she was in the hospital this summer. Do you know, Jeffrey, how she's feeling, how she's doing? Is she beating this cancer thing that keeps coming back?
She has issued a statement accepting the Liberty Medal. She authorized it yesterday, so we're really looking forward to sharing that. The statement said that the experience of seeing the videos has lifted her spirits, which was wonderful to hear, and we're all thinking and praying for her, and we're so glad to offer her this tribute in the hope of lifting her spirits.
I mean, you could have picked anybody. I mean, it is the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. Was it a struggle to decide Justice Ginsburg for the Liberty Medal this year?
No, certainly not. I mean, no. Of course it wasn't for me. And I just essentially recused myself from the decision because we're so close. But the Board of Trustees of the National Constitution Center enthusiastically, and I think they suggested it, it was one of our board members suggested it, and everyone enthusiastically embraced it. And she's joining, as she notes, previous Liberty Medal recipients, including Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Thurgood Marshall, and Anthony Kennedy. So she's not the first Supreme Court justice, but it's impossible to imagine a better year to award her the Liberty Medal than on the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment.
She is the second woman to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court, and she told you, Jeffrey, about Sandra Day O'Connor. She was the, quote, most helpful big sister anyone could have. And this is when Justice Ginsburg joined the Supreme Court.
Yes, it was a really important support that Justice O'Connor gave Justice Ginsburg. They bonded over disparities like the fact that there was no women's restroom that was in easy access of the conference room of the Supreme Court. And soon after, Justice O'Connor had to endure that for years. And as soon as Justice Ginsburg arrived, that situation was quickly remedied. Justice O'Connor gave her advice when she had her first cancer treatment about how to survive it and keep up with her work. And when Justice Ginsburg wrote her first opinion and delivered it, Justice O'Connor passed her a note on the bench saying, "This is your first opinion. It is a fine one. I look forward to many more." They were not always together. And in fact, they disagreed about very, very important cases, including Bush v. Gore, where Justice Ginsburg wrote a very fierce dissent and disapproved of the majority opinion. But they were personally close. They supported each other. They shared the experience of being trailblazers, women who were always first, and it was very meaningful to both of them.
Well, we are talking about RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, with Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Jeffrey Rosen. He's the CEO of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And tomorrow, the center is giving Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg their 2020 Liberty Award. And it's also National Constitution Day tomorrow. And, of course, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. Jeffrey Rosen has known RBG for decades now and wrote a book just last year called Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and the Law. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Jeffrey, I do want to talk about some of her decisions and her thinking about the law. You mentioned Justice Thurgood Marshall. And in many ways, for her sort of judicial and I guess even constitutional thinking, he was really a role model for her. Explain what she saw in Justice Thurgood Marshall.
Justice Marshall was indeed a role model. His great achievement as an advocate was to proceed incrementally in challenging racial discrimination he understood that desegregating public schools was the most politically controversial of all the desegregation efforts. So he started instead with colleges and law schools and public facilities, and only brought the Brown versus Board of Education case after having laid a foundation for striking down separate facilities in other realms. And Justice Ginsburg did the same thing in a different way. Her great insight as an advocate was to represent men who'd been disadvantaged by laws that purportedly favored women, but in practice created paternalistic stereotypes that disadvantaged them. So one of her most important cases was the Wiesenfeld case, where she represented a man whose wife had died, and he sought survivor's benefits under Social Security in order to care for their young son. The Social Security laws at the time only gave survivor's benefits to women, not men, under the stereotypical assumption that only women could be primary caregivers. And Justice Ginsburg, representing the man, Stephen Wiesenfeld, understood that this would appeal to the mostly male, often sexist judges of her time, who were more likely to empathize with a man than with a woman. So she won that case, and she represented a series of men in similar situation, and women as well. And in the process, slowly over her important Supreme Court arguments, established the principle that discrimination on the basis of sex is nearly as suspicious constitutionally as discrimination on the basis of race. And in that sense, we say at the Liberty Medal that if Thurgood Marshall was the most important advocate for racial equality of his time, Justice Ginsburg is the most important advocate for gender equality of our time.
Well, and it gets more interesting, I think, and perhaps even more complicated with her criticism of Roe v. Wade. And part of your conversations with her, Jeff, has to do with how she viewed that decision. Of course, that goes back to the 1970s. She argued that it should have been argued on this issue of equality, not privacy. Why was she making that argument? And what does that tell us about her thinking about the Constitution and things like equality and discrimination and justice?
Well, she was extraordinarily prescient in arguing that abortion's restrictions should have been conceived as violations of equality and not the privacy of mostly male doctors talking to their dependent women patients. Back in the 1970s, there was a case involving a servicewoman called Susan Strzok, who was disadvantaged by regulations that basically said if you got pregnant in the armed forces, you had to leave. It was a discriminatory regulation. And Justice Ginsburg recognized, then Advocate Ginsburg, that restrictions on reproductive choice impose burdens on women that are not imposed on men. By requiring women to bear unwanted children, restrictions on abortion redirect the life paths of women in ways that discriminate in their ability to choose their own destinies. And that incredibly powerful insight, Justice Ginsburg, rooted in the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, which says that no state shall deny any person equal protection of the law. By contrast, Roe v. Wade, decided on the ground of the right to privacy, relied on a right that doesn't appear in the text of the Constitution. And there were critics of Roe, and Justice Ginsburg was only one of many liberal supporters of reproductive choice who thought that the reasoning of Roe was not constitutionally persuasive because it never clearly identified what the constitutional peg for this right to privacy was. And Justice Ginsburg also said it's a paternalistic assumption that you have to protect the privacy of doctors to make their own decisions. It's the woman's right that's at stake. And finally, you're right that it's complicated, but it's important to just walk through the grounds of her criticism. She said the result in Roe was absolutely right. She had no doubt that the court should have struck down an extreme Texas law that allowed for essentially no exceptions for abortion except for the life of the mother. But she would have stopped there. And she thought the court went too far in creating an elaborate trimester system that says you can have no restrictions in the first trimester and more in the second and more in the third. That, she said, was too legislative and also stopped a political trend toward liberalization of abortion laws that she was confident would have continued had the court not stepped in. She noted that New York and other states were just on the verge of liberalizing their abortion laws. And if the court hadn't basically short-circuited that whole debate, then the abortion situation might have been liberalized without judicial intervention. She thought that the very sweeping nature of the Roe decision created a backlash that mobilized the pro-life movement, that made every judicial nomination a referendum onto Roe v. Wade, and in the end polarized the abortion debate more than it had to be. So it was an extremely sophisticated and quite prescient critique. And the last thing I'll say to, in appreciation of her vision was that the Supreme Court eventually came around to her notion that equality was an important constitutional value in abortion. And when it reaffirmed Roe in 1992, the majority opinion emphasized the importance of women's equality.
I'm asking you to speculate here, but if Roe were overturned, of course, you know, that's a speculative question. Would Justice Ginsburg then favor states making their own abortion laws, depending on sort of what the current thinking is in that particular state?
No, she's very clear that in each abortion case that the court has decided, she has either ruled in favor of the women seeking reproductive choice and fiercely dissented when the court has allowed restrictions on, for example, so-called partial birth abortions, which she thought were decided on the basis of outdated stereotypes about women. So for her, women's equality is a strong enough rationale to strike down most of the restrictions on abortion that are now before the courts. But she does say, I asked her many times, you know, do you think Roe will be overturned? She said, as long as the court maintains its current balance, it's up to Chief Justice John Roberts. And she does not believe that he would vote to overturn Roe formally or cleanly, although it might be narrowed. She doesn't think that he would vote completely to overturn it. However, she notes that if Roe were overturned, the biggest impact would be on poor women. She says women of means will be able to have access to abortion just as they do now in states like Pennsylvania, I believe, certainly New York and California. Anyone of means will be able to exercise reproductive choice. It's women in states where abortion is already very restricted and where there are few clinics already, that those few clinics might close and they would have to travel to other states to get abortion, and women without means would not be able to do that. So she really sees it as a question of economic burdens that she's very concerned about.
Well, let me play, and this is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is actually a couple of years ago. She's on CBS Sunday Morning talking very specifically about Roe and about abortion. Let's hear Justice Ginsburg in her own words speaking to what Jeffrey Rosen was just saying.
Better to go step by step and have a series of decisions rather than have one decision that made every law of every state, even the most liberal, unconstitutional. Too giant a stride. There are many people who disagree with me who say that the backlash would have occurred in any event, and we will never know.
And again, that's Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We are talking about her with our guest, Jeffrey Rosen. He's head of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. And this year, tomorrow evening, as a matter of fact, Justice Ginsburg is receiving their 2020 Liberty Medal. And if you want to join our conversation, again, you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions about RBG. And I should add that Jeffrey Rosen wrote a book about his many conversations with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it is called Conversations with RBG. Jeff, let me just add something else that you write about. And this is, again, some feminists who opposed even Ginsburg's vision of gender equality. And this is in the 1980s, going so far as to call her phallocentric and assimilationist. What was the criticism, and what was her response?
Well, it really is a debate that took place long ago, and many of those divisions have been patched up. But it was between broadly a group of feminists who called themselves equal treatment feminists, and different treatment feminists and the equal treatment feminists, of whom Justice Ginsburg considered herself one, believed that the law should treat men and women equally and not have preferences for either gender. And different feminists thought that in some circumstances, the law should make accommodation for characteristics that were specific to women. And the particular place where this came to a head was over the question of pregnancy discrimination. The question was whether employers should be able to treat pregnancy, should be able to give people benefits or provide support when women were pregnant. And the equal treatment feminists said, well, just as men who had prostate cancer would have their health care paid for, so women who were pregnant should have the same. The difference feminists said, no, pregnancy was different, and therefore there should be special benefits. To make things even more complicated, the Supreme Court decided this in a really weird opinion called the Gedaldig case, where they said, actually, women who are pregnant are not similarly situated to men who are ill, because only women can become pregnant. The distinction is between pregnant women and non-pregnant persons. So therefore, women couldn't get the benefits. Justice Ginsburg didn't like that. She argued that Congress should overturn it. It did so in the Pregnancy Discrimination Act. But that technicality is really important, because as long as that decision remains on the books, then it's harder to support Justice Ginsburg's arguments that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy is a form of gender discrimination, because the court has said, no, you're not being discriminated on the basis of gender. You're being discriminated on the basis of your pregnancy status, ignoring the fact that only women can become pregnant. So that it was something of an internecine debate, but as I say now, it's been largely patched up.
In her many conversations with you, she's describes herself as incrementalist and using other I guess constitutional words, but also even describing her position on the Constitution and the court and the law as being conservative. And she seemed to be saying, look, I've pretty much stayed the same. It's the court that has moved right. Can you, I'm asking you to be RBG whisperer here, but can you explain her how she fits in, I guess, in this sort of liberal-conservative dichotomy?
Yes. The first question, as you say, is, has she changed? And she always insisted to me, oh, Jeff, she'd say, I didn't change. The court changed. And the big change, she said, was when Justice O'Connor retired and was replaced by Justice Alito. And then she would just reel off the number of 5-4 decisions that would have gone the other way if Justice O'Connor had still been on the court, ranging from affirmative action to other sure. crucially important questions like that. Although she acknowledged when I pressed her that she felt that her role changed when she became the senior associate justice for the majority when Justice Stevens retired in 2010, and she became responsible for assigning majority opinions when she was in the majority or dissents when she was in dissent. So she thought it was important for the dissenters to speak in one voice. She would often take the most important dissents to write them, as Justice Stevens did, and that, she felt, gave her it was important for her to speak with a powerful clarity, and the tone of her decisions changed. But as for her being a liberal, a conservative, what most surprised me, we were talking about constitutional interpretation, and I said, you're of course not an originalist. And she said, I am an originalist. I believe that the original Constitution was designed to become ever more embracive. So the fact that she embraced that label, although obviously interpreted it very differently than her sure. friend Justice Scalia, suggests that she never saw herself on the court as a liberal crusader. That was her role as an advocate. On the court, she thought her job was to preserve or conserve or be an incrementalist or just correctly to interpret the law. She has a very clear sense of role. And that's why she always would note to me, maybe this is, these labels are confusing, but she always insisted that she was the most restrained judge on the court, judged by the number of federal laws she'd voted to strike down. She voted to strike down fewer federal laws at one point than any other justice. And for her, that was the definition of judicial restraint.
Let me get Luann. She just hung up, so I will. We'll get back to our callers in just a second or two. She, though, really did not like the. I mean, that's not a very constitutional or legal word, but she really opposed the court's decision on Bush v. Gore. What was her argument against that? And my understanding was Justice O'Connor. They really diverged on Bush v. Gore.
Well, she sure did oppose it. She made no secret of her displeasure, and she believed that it was an astonishing short-circuiting of the ordinary judicial system. She was especially concerned about the lack of deference to the state judges in Florida, who she felt were doing their job. And Justice Stevens said this will just promote the most cynical views of judges because people will think that judges are just acting as politicians. And Justice Ginsburg agreed. She was very deferential to other branches of the judiciary, just as she was to Congress. And she thought it was made up jurisprudence designed to throw the presidential election. And she said so.
I mean, it'd be interesting to keep that in mind. We don't know what's going to happen in November, but it certainly feels as if we could be headed to not Bush v. Gore, but Trump v. Biden.
Well, we have a vision of how Justice Ginsburg feels about electoral cases because she wrote just a few months ago the dissent in the very memorably named Republican National Committee versus Democratic National Committee case arising out of Wisconsin. And that was the case where the governor wanted to extend the deadline that ballots mailed after Election Day but received before the date a few days later that everyone agreed was the drop-dead deadline would be counted. And the court said, no, if they're not mailed by Election Day, you can't count them. And she said, this is crazy. This is not an ordinary election. Lots of people are going to be disenfranchised. They won't even receive their ballots. Turns out she was right. Tens of thousands of people didn't get the ballots because of COVID. And she does not like judicial intervention in elections at the last minute.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is in Philadelphia. He's written a number of books, including Conversations with RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Life, Love, Liberty, and the Law. The center is giving Ginsburg its 2020 Liberty Medal at an online event tomorrow, Thursday evening. And you can join us. Again, you can always send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another clip. Again, this is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she's speaking on CBS Sunday Morning. This is just a couple of years ago about the lack of women on the U.S. Supreme Court.
People ask me, when would you be satisfied with the number of women on the court? When there are nine. For most of the country's history, they were all white men.
And again, that's Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Let me get Charles to join us. And he's calling in on line two on Radio Times. And Charles, go ahead. You are on the air.
Yes. This is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Let me get Charles to join us.
Oh, dear. Okay, let me just read his comment here, just so we have it for Jeff. Charles said, I had dinner with RBG a few years ago when she told me that she views the Supreme Court not as the be-all or end-all, but as an evolving body. I was going to ask him how he was able to have dinner with Justice Ginsburg, but nonetheless, is that how your conversations about the court, Jeff, have gone with Ginsburg seeing it as an evolving body?
Yes, I think that's a good phrase. She believes that society evolves, and she's always said that the court should reflect societal evolution rather than causing it. In other words, she thinks the court operates by gentle nudges and applying small breaks, but that real social change comes from the ground up, from the mobilized activism of young women today. She's especially proud of her granddaughter, Clara, for arguing on behalf of gender equality, for the women of her generation, for the civil rights movement. She doesn't think the judges are the major drivers of social change. And she understands that the court evolves dramatically. She told me that she felt that she hadn't changed, but the court changed dramatically. Justice Stevens said that every justice appointed during his term was more conservative than the justice who that person succeeded, except for Justice Ginsburg, who replaced Byron White, and she understood that too. So she understood the importance of who's on the court and also the need for the court to be sensitive to changes in society.
Luann had a comment saying, considering RBG's thoughts on incrementalism, how does she view something like the Equal Rights Amendment, which required sweeping change? Did she ever talk to you about that?
She did, and it's a great question. And she enthusiastically supported the Equal Rights Amendment, and she believes that the Equal Rights Amendment should be ratified. To the disappointment of some supporters of the ERA, though, she believes that Congress should go back to square one. You know, there's an argument that when Virginia ratified the ERA last year, it provided the necessary three-quarter votes to make it part of the Constitution. Justice Ginsburg thinks because the original ERA had a time limit in it, which has expired for mm-hmm. ratification, and also because some states have rescinded their ratifications, it would be safer and better to remove all doubt by starting from the beginning. But as for how does she reconcile that with her incrementalism, she's an incrementalist on the court. She's a judicial incrementalist, but she's not an incrementalist as an advocate and a citizen. And she believes that that women will not achieve full equality without adding the ERA to the Constitution. And that's why she encourages women and men across the country to advocate for the ratification of the ERA. And she hopes that it will eventually be ratified.
Jeff, let me read something that Justice Ginsburg said in 2013. This was, in 2016, when Donald Trump was running for president. And then I do want to play a clip where she responds to some of the criticism that she got. This is quoting Justice Ginsburg about Donald Trump. He was then candidate Trump. He has no consistency about him. He says whatever comes into his head at the moment. He really has an ego. How has he gotten away with not turning over his tax returns? Turns. The press seems to be very gentle with him on that. I can't imagine what this place would be like with Donald Trump as our president. She, of course, a member of the U.S. Supreme Court. She was asked about this. Again, this is CBS Sunday Morning in 2016. Let's hear what she has to say. And then, Jeff, I'll give you a chance to respond as well.
Judges should not talk about political candidates. And the press has blown this up out of all proportion. So I would prefer not to add anything to what I have already said.
Jeff, did she go too far as a member of the Supreme Court, which, of course, rules on and has ruled on all sorts of things about presidential authority?
I think that she herself acknowledged that she had gone too far. She said that she shouldn't have said what she said. Michael Kinsley, the great journalist in the 1980s, defined a gaffe in Washington as a public figure who tells the truth. And I think that she may have, she didn't say this. This is not her. This is
right.
me.
No.
But it may be an example of a Kinsley gaffe. And she apologized for it. And she acknowledged that as a judge, she should not have been talking publicly about politics.
Well, let me quote something from the president, President Trump, who said not so long ago, and this was, you know, we've been fighting a lot about presidential authority. He said, and I'm quoting here, when somebody's the president of the United States, the authority is total. What does the Constitution help us understand about a presidential authority and also presidential responsibility to the Constitution and to the law?
Well, now I'll go back to my nonpartisan National Constitution Center role and say that members of both parties acknowledge that the president's claim that he has total authority is completely unsupported by the text of the Constitution or its original understanding. One dramatic example is Alexander Hamilton, who was the greatest advocate of executive power, so much so that at the convention he argued for an elected monarch, a president who would be elected for life. And even he emphasized in the Federalist Papers that in many respects, the president has less power than the King of England or the governor of New York City. And he gave examples like the governor can declare war by sending state troops, but the president can't. It's Congress that can declare war. And of course, the king has total authority to throw his enemies in jail and has the ultimate sovereign power. In the U.S., we the people have the sovereign power. And then even down to questions like whether you can dismiss Congress, which President Trump floated the idea of doing without its consent. Alexander Hamilton said, no, that the king and the governor might be able to dismiss their legislatures, but the president can't, except under very limited circumstances.
Well, the court ruled unanimously this summer that the president is not above the law, and they rejected this absolute immunity. This is a whole argument about tax returns, which actually Justice Ginsburg referenced when it was candidate Trump running for president. But it does feel as if things get kind of bogged down in the courts. I don't know whether you see it that way, Jeffrey, or not.
Well, they certainly get tangled up, whether you want to say bogged down or tangled up, or they end up in the courts. There's no question about it. De Tocqueville, the 19th century observer, famously said that in America, every important political question becomes a judicial question. But there's no doubt that especially since the 1960s and increasingly recently, as we get more and more polarized, more and more questions involving elections and voting rights and political rights have ended up before the courts. So just descriptively, that's where we are.
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing about the president's tax returns, I mean, this has been sort of tossed around in courts and in Congress for years now. And at the same time, those tax returns remain private. We don't know them.
That's true. And the president, as we know, reading the newspapers, the New York Attorney General has asked for the tax returns. The president's lawyers have argued once again that the request is too broad. The judge is ruling on those claims, but the wheels of justice or the wheels of the legal system do not always move quickly, and there are statutes of limitations involved. And when presidential claims of immunity are thrown in, that makes things even slower.
Here's an email from Jane. Regarding Justice Ginsburg's opinion that Roe v. Wade should have been decided on the basis of discrimination according to gender, does the recent Supreme Court decision protecting LGBTQ workers from discrimination set any precedent for further decisions regarding reproductive health decisions? Jane goes on to say, I think the majority decision was that discriminating against a transgender worker would be on the basis of gender and therefore would be unconstitutional. Can you untangle that, Jeffrey?
Jane, that is a wonderful question. And there's no doubt that this landmark decision written by Justice Neil Gorsuch and joined by Chief Justice Roberts, as well as by Justice Ginsburg, 6-3 decision, extends to LGBTQ people the same protections that had been available under Title VII for women. Now, but it's possible because it's so sweeping in its unequivocal interpretation of the phrase because of sex, that it might be invoked to strike down forms of gender discrimination against women that it had not previously been invoked for. Nevertheless, the statute had been interpreted, of course, to protect women before this decision. So some of these cases have been litigated. But it's a good example of how even a conservative textualist like Justice Gorsuch will strongly protect discrimination on the basis of sex when he thinks the text of the law requires it, regardless of what Congress thought as an original matter. Here, Jane, this is what I think might be most useful. Justice Gorsuch says it doesn't matter the fact that people, you know, that language was added in 1964 because a congressperson thought it would be a joke. He just stuck it in because he thought that it would lead people to vote against the bill. Justice Gorsuch says it doesn't matter what he had in mind or what Congress thought the act would do. Once the language is in there, we have to interpret it as broadly as possible.
Oh, that's fascinating. How would you describe the Roberts Court? I mean, it's obviously still going, but he's had a number of years under his belt. How do you see it, Jeff?
Well, he had a remarkable term last year. I think we discussed it, Marty.
And we did.
Chief Justice Roberts, as many have noted, is now the most influential Chief Justice since Charles Evans Hughes in 1937. He sided with the liberals in important cases. He tried to create unanimous rather than 5-4 decisions and nearly succeeded in important cases. So he very much sees his role as preserving the legitimacy of the court at a time when the court is so polarized and avoiding these 5-4 conservative splits. Justice Ginsburg told me in our conversations over the years that so much would be up to him in terms of whether or not the court polarized, and that's why his role is so crucially important.
Well, I wonder, too, and this is, again, looking ahead to November, and you know, you hear this on both the left and the right, that depending on who wins or who loses or whether we don't know, that there could be chaos. How do you see the U.S. Supreme Court helping, maybe like Bush v. Gore, but maybe a different decision, maybe a same decision? How do you see the court helping to sort of right the ship of state?
Well, I don't know about helping. The difficulty is that the court made clear in that Republican National Committee versus Democratic National Committee decision that at least five justices embrace a principle. It's called the Purcell principle for listeners who want to check out the decision, the Purcell decision. They're generally suspicious of efforts to change election counting rules at the last minute. So if a state is having chaos in counting ballots and comes up with some new rule for counting the ballots, the Supreme Court, if it gets involved, is likely to be suspicious of that and say they can't do that. Now, this won't matter unless we have another Bush v. Gore-like situation where in a swing state, things are so close that the counting rules matter. But if that happens and one or two of these state cases end up before the U.S. Supreme Court, then God save the USA.
Wow. Really? I mean, that's a little scary.
Well, let's not let's be descriptive friends of all perspectives, whether you know, regardless of who you support for president. Let's take things one step at a time, recognizing that the Constitution does provide clear rules for the resolution of most electoral disputes. And generally, almost all the important decisions are going to be made state by state. It's not up to the president. We know he cannot change the election. Everyone agreed when he said he might that he can't do that. It's very rare for the Supreme Court to intervene, and I'm quite sure that they won't unless they believe they have to. So unless the stars are aligned so that things are so close in a swing state that the U.S. Supreme Court believes it has to get involved, then the election will be decided at the state level, which is why it's so important that each state make decisions about how to count ballots now. But and also pay close attention to the state court decisions that are playing out. Wisconsin just last week first said that a Green Party candidate might have to be added to the ballot and the ballots would have to be reprinted and then changed its mind, saying there wasn't time to do that. That was a hugely consequential decision. And state courts right now are making decisions that are just as likely to influence the direction of the election as the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, these are interesting times. Jeffrey Rosen, as always, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. And everyone tune in tomorrow, 6:30 at the Constitution Center website, constitutioncenter.org, for the 2020 Liberty Medal awarded to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, which is in Philadelphia. And again, wrote a book about his many conversations with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it is called Conversations with RBG. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can also download a podcast of this and many of our other programs, years of programs, wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.